She truly loves justice, and she truly wants us to live in a more racially inclusive environment. And she will do the work here with others to help bring that about. It's always, for me, the most exciting thing to come to a school and talk with students. So that I've had passionate dialogue with students here, many of them, the women of color on this row here, and the students earlier today, talking about social justice. I feel like we're in a very interesting time in our nation because people feel a tremendous amount of hopelessness about justice and about our capacity to change. And it has made me think a lot about what inspires us to resist. I told my group earlier that I'm a little saddened to come to Lewis and Clark and see that there are fewer Black students today than there were when I first came here. And we talked, the students are so excited about the possibility of ethnic studies here. And we talked about how important ethnic studies is for every student. I told them how I get letters, particularly from my Yale students, who say, you know, when I took your class, you made me so angry, but then now that I'm the only white person in charge of a whole group of people of color, I recognize how important those lessons of unlearning racism, of learning about other groups were in preparing you to work in today's world. I feel especially lucky. You know, even I haven't been feeling well, and I wasn't sure that I should make this journey to Portland. But you can't know that hearing that all the tickets are sold out, it's such a wonderful thing to be a Black woman writer living today and to know that people really read and study and appreciate your work. So I want to say a heartfelt thanks to all of you, professors and students, who read and study my work and who want to hear what it is I have to say and who inspire me to keep going, even when I feel weary. I'm especially lucky to have been born in the early part of the 1950s, for I was able to witness firsthand during my girlhood racial apartheid and that period in our nation's history where sexist gender roles were reinscribed to wipe out the glimpses of equality created by 20s rebellion and the impact of imperialist war on work. And then witness the marvelous cultural revolution in our society created by civil rights and feminist movement. Making the transition from girlhood into young womanhood at a time when our nation was in transition, breaking with patterns of domination and the racialized colonialism that had characterized the conquest and terrorization of Native American Indians and later their African counterparts. Rebellion and resistance and revolution, the will to transform myself and demand transformation within the country and culture where I am most at home is my birthright. The legacy of the times in which I was born and grew into mature womanhood. While there are many ways we learn, many epistemologies, that is, ways of knowing, we all know that experience coupled with awareness and critical reflection about what is happening around us and why is one of life's great teachers. To have been raised during our nation's period of legally sanctioned apartheid, where so many rights were denied us based on the color of our skin, to stand before stores that would not allow us to enter, to see the closing of our beloved Black schools and to board the buses in the wee hours of the morning, it took us away from the world that was most familiar to us into a strange, horribly racist world where we would always be treated as second-class citizens, never the equals of the white children who were our peers and sometimes, on rare occasions, our allies and our friends, was to know firsthand the anguish and the pain, the fear and the subordination. But it was also to know firsthand the sweetness of solidarity, of struggle, of standing in resistance. In September, I went back to my little town that I grew up in to give a talk. And with me at that talk were the white friends, my friend Anne that I write about in Wounds of Passion, that I had grown up with, who had dared to stand against white supremacy at a time where, you know, all of you young white people out here, you take it for granted that you can be with friends with whomever you want to be friends with. But for us, in those years of racial apartheid, to choose to have a friend who was white, to choose, if you were white, to have a friend who was black, was such, you know, an amazing, dangerous thing. We were run off the road. Our parents questioned us. You know, why did we need to cross the tracks and be friends with one another? I think about that because I think of our solidarities that have lasted through the years. And I think about what it means to have solidarity and community. Especially when I come to locations that are predominantly white, because often in locations that are predominantly white, people feel like, well, the issue of racism and community building that is inclusive and diversity isn't really our issue. It isn't really, you know, of concern to us. And at the college that I teach at, I teach at Berea College, the average income of parents of our students are $28,000. It's a need-based Christian college. And by saying need-based, none of our students pay tuition. We have seven commitments that govern our school, and one of them is the dignity of labor, so they work. But one of the things that we are committed to is impartial love, because the white male who began Berea College had a vision, and it was a religious vision. In fact, the very name Berea, if you know your Bible, if you're a Christian, is about a place, a utopian place where people are open to hearing the word. So that there at Berea, there's this foundation at this predominantly white school now of a tradition of creating a community where people can live together. But one of the things we keep teaching is that it doesn't mean that race and ending racism and white supremacy is only important if people of color are around. It's like, oh, if people of color are not around, we can exist in our white supremacy just totally comfortably. And then when they show up, we can think about the questions of diversity, of inclusion. To have lived in the 50s, when the violence against women and children that I saw in our community went unnoticed and uncared about. To know that women stayed with men because they couldn't get jobs, not have bank accounts and credit cards. All these were the ways I learned about sexism and patriarchy. Living to see serious change, being a part of both the struggle for racial and gender justice, and seeing profound changes occur has given me a foundation of hope that sustains and strengthens my activism. To have witnessed the profound cultural revolution in our nation as changes happened that made racial and gender justice more common, more a reality and not simply a dream, I cannot give up hope, even though it is clear that we are a nation that is daily reneging on its promise to end racism and white supremacy, that is daily stripping women of hard-earned equal rights. As much as we are theoretically a nation that speaks about democracy with pride, a nation wherein many citizens like to feel there is freedom and justice for all, we are more essentially a nation that has enshrined patterns of unjust, corrupt inequality that are long-standing. The very same greed for material advancement which characterized Columbus's journey to the so-called New World the slaughter and colonization of indigenous people so that Europe could expand its power, still threatens to take the lives of people of color in our nation, and black people in particular. Enlightened people of color, black people, now know far more than our ancestors ever realized about the extent to which greed and the desire of the few to put in place and maintain an unjust and inequitable economic system was at the heart of the conquest of Native people, the enslavement of Africans, the indentured servitude of poor whites, and not simply xenophobia or white supremacy. Ultimately, for a time in our nation's history, that greed coexisted with visions of justice and freedom for all. I think it's impossible, with both the death of Rosa Parks and Coretta Scott King, to not feel that sort of period of life where people were so empowered to think about justice and freedom. It's not a waning energy in our lives. These progressive visions, which were and are the heartbeat of democracy, provided a system of beliefs, morals, and values that were the foundation of critical interventions, which led to the formation of a culture of resistance, where domination, exploitation, and oppression were challenged and opposed. This spirit of resistance has been the foundation of all movements for social justice in our society. It has been the bedrock of our hope in the midst of suffering. Despite the legacy of struggle, of commitment to freedom and justice, we are witnessing at this time a consolidated attempt on the part of combined forces of domination, which many of us consistently and courageously call imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy, to kill this spirit of resistance and in the process create a culture without hope. A culture wherein the belief that materialism is all that matters and the politics of greed are the only real foundation needed to give life meaning reign supreme. Such a culture is a breeding ground for fascism. Right now, we are witnessing a resurgence of white supremacy, of Nazism, of all manner of Holocaust globally, enacted in the name of racial and ethnic purity. In the past, among citizens of the United States, the will to resist injustice emerged most often among those individuals whose religious beliefs were the foundation of their activism, enabling them to courageously stand and challenge racism, materialism, sexism, homophobia. When we look at the history of civil rights and black liberation struggle, it's clearly evident that the vast majority of our visionary leaders and activists were famous, whether famous or unknown, found their strength to struggle within the context of efforts to embody in theory and practice the tenets of spiritual faith rooted in the love and will to end domination. For Martin Luther King and Septima Clark, his faith was Christianity. For Malcolm X, it was Islam. Among white allies in struggle, Christian faith and Judaism enhanced political concerns with justice. This is rarely the case today. Indeed, the more progressive an individual's political view in our society today, the more likely they are to be agnostic or atheist. And a vast majority of progressive folks who believe in God and higher powers in no way link their beliefs to organized religious traditions and ritual. Religion, and in particularly fundamentalism, is one of the primary tools used by conservative individuals who wish to perpetuate and sustain imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. Radical progressive religious voices are not as unified as the religious right. The right has garnered the services of mass media to send its messages globally. Irrespective of their color, television evangelists share conservative perspectives. Ironically, while New Age spirituality, complete with politically informed revisioning of gender, is on the rise, popular gurus say little or nothing And much of the writing valorizes prosperity in such a way as to make synonymous wealth and well-being. Among young people across the nation, fundamentalist religious thinking, whether coming from Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, etc., appeals because it offers absolute guidelines that promise stability in a world where everything is constantly shifting. At a small liberal arts college with religious affiliation, young white students stand to tell me, Black people are creating racism by focusing on difference, by calling attention to Blackness, that if we would quote, just accept that we are all one in Christ, racism would not exist. At a hip-hop panel with celebrity young Black entertainers, an old patriarchal testament, an Old Testament patriarchal God of discipline and punishment is evoked as the ultimate judge and arbiter of human behavior. That is, I'm with these hip-hop guys and somebody asks them, well, you know, because you know how the hip-hop boys always have to get up and say, I just want to thank God. And my mother. And so someone at this hip-hop event said to them, well, how can you evoke God and then write these lyrics that are misogynist and that call for the exploitation of women, that celebrate rape and predatory sexuality? And then they invoke God as, well, nobody can judge that God is the ultimate judge and arbiter of human behavior. And at this hip-hop panel, I noticed that little attention was given individual responsibility for moral and ethical choices. And I was struck by the fact that both these groups are fiercely homophobic, use Christianity to justify their anti-gay sentiments. Fundamentalist religious thinking has undergirded practically every major act of racial terror with prison we have witnessed in the last few years in this society and much of the racial terrorism which precedes it. Progressive religious beliefs, which extol the virtues of compassion, a love ethic, and sharing of resources, are needed if we are to rekindle a spirit of resistance where domination is always challenged and opposed. The radical religious left needs to come together and create a public voice for itself. Religion is important because it's there that many folks learn the Western metaphysical dualism, the notion of a world divided between good and bad, the chosen and the unchosen, the worthy and the unworthy, the Black and white, that is the philosophical foundation for white supremacy and other forms of domination. As long as this thinking serves as the foundation of how most people think about life, then it will be impossible to eradicate racism and other forms of domination. Imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy thrives on the core dualistic thinking that is the foundation of all systems of domination. Recently, I was telling people earlier that we have these lectures at our school where everybody has to come to them, all the students that were required to come. And I was told when I gave my lecture this year, could you just tone it down? The students really have a hard time with this concept of imperialist white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. And I've been teasing people like, it's okay for the students to do cocaine. Keep us down, oppressed, exploited, or whatever, but how these systems work together. Either through our denial, it's like the people you know who would say, like I have to tell people like during the Katrina disaster, that if people had no sound, most people in the US would have said, what country is this? You know, what third world country is this? Like all the white folks, the privileged white people that have been going to New Orleans and partying and never saw all those poor black people driving from the airport. You know, I mean, it's so fascinating when you think about the idea that somehow people never understood the level of poverty that many people in our nation live within. And I always tell people the face of poverty in America is white. You know, there are 38 billion, is it billion or I always get numbers confused, poor people in our nation, and many of them are white. And I always say they live in these sort of outer limits of whiteness, like Maine, and you know, and when you drive around, white people live in shanty towns, in shanty housing structures that look like you're in South Africa or somewhere. But you would not see those people. If you've been to Korea, I know some of you older people have probably been to Korea. It's so cute and quaint, our little town, I really love it. But if you just stay on the surface of our town, you wouldn't see that white poverty. Because you have to usually go up in the hills. You have to search it out to see it. Which is why so many Americans, and I'm telling you, believe there is no problem of poverty for white people in this nation. And really believe that the face of poverty is black or brown. And we were talking about that today, even talking about ethnic studies, how important it is for us to deconstruct the category of whiteness as not always being this category of privilege. That there is history and experience of poor white people that are voiceless or that have struggled to come to voice, as we see in Appalachia and with our Appalachian studies as we try to recover the voices of white and black Appalachia in Kentucky and in the surrounding areas. So I wrote in here about why I think it's useful to talk about white supremacy and instead of racism. And I also like white supremacy because it allows us as people of color and black people to see the ways we internalize racism and enact it in our lives as white supremacy, so that we cannot see ourselves as merely innocent victims, but we see our own agency. For example, for black people, I mean, aren't you amazed that the color caste can still exist? I mean, doesn't it break your heart to know that lots of children of color are bleaching their skin every day because at 5 years old they're learning that blackness is not something you want to be? I think about that all the time, that shouldn't we have cleaned this up ages ago? Should there be any little kid of color, any little black kid that isn't able to come into this world and learn how to love themselves? And instead, what these kids are learning are how to hate themselves. I don't know how many of you read Jonathan Kozol's new book on education and how in the inner cities of our nation, education is being resegregated, where there's hardly even a book you can read in a lot of these elementary schools. He tells the testimony of all these little kids of color, black and Hispanic kids, saying how they want to go to where he lives, so they can see the books and the things that the white kids have to play with in their schools and to learn from. It's so profoundly amazing. You know, it's amazing. I know you've heard Mr. Bush talk about math and science. You know, the most essential problem of education in our nation, people, and people of color, hear me say this, is literacy. Literacy, not math and science. Basic reading and writing skills. Especially for people of color. Black males are swiftly becoming the most illiterate group in our society. Not math and science. I mean, Etherington,
today's world and not doing it right. It's just kind of, I mean, you know, I'm that crazy person. I read a book a day. And actually, I try to read one nonfiction book a day, but I read a lot of trash. I'm like the ultimate murder mystery person. And my world is so focused around reading. And I was asked telling students today that I'm obsessed with education because I can read bell hooks because of public education that allowed me a space to read. And I talked about my fundamentalist Christian parents and Foucault's idea that there's no closed system. And the open space in my life as a girl was the space to read. And the place that offered me a taste of freedom was the public library. So I have to do my bit for reminding us of the need for supporting our public libraries. Because there's so much in young people the right to read and write, the right to have access. I talked today about philosopher Anthony Appiah's African and British parents, and he was saying that when Joe Appiah died, he told him, remember, you are a citizen of the world. And in his new book, Cosmopolitanisms, he talks about the fact that wouldn't it be interesting if we would stop using the term diversity and recover a vision of what it is to be truly cosmopolitan. To think of yourself as being a part of the world and of learning from that world. And for me, whenever people ask me, you know, well, how did you come out of, you know, that home or that family or that Kentucky backwoods town, it was through that world of cosmopolitanism that this allowed me. Being able to know that there was a horizon beyond that which my parents presented to me. And being able to look for that horizon. You think about what that goes if you were reading Zora Neale, how much she talked about the horizon and that image of a world beyond that little place where she resides. And so one of the things, the thing in the Bible that I tell people, when I moved to Berea, you know, I saw all these, like, what I thought, everybody's trying to sell their home. And they went, no, it's not or for sale, it's not, it's the Ten Commandments. So I think that it's really for all of us who live in progressive enclaves in this nation, it's important to be mindful of what is happening in the Bible Belt. What is happening with the resurgence of fundamentalist Christianity, because people actually don't want to expand their horizons. You know, it has been a challenge to me to teach at a Christian college because I find that my students are by and large not interested in critical thinking, that they quote the Bible to me. And of course, I understand this because this is the tradition that I was raised in as well. You know, my mother always tells me that, you know, I wouldn't have to be a Christian if I was just prayer.
Very fundamentalist parents and being who you are. How do you this teacher Pima Schroeder and said, you have to stop where people are. That will tell me, oh, when I go home, you know, and they say, well, who will say the prayer? I raise my hand, I want to say the prayer, and then I pray for my parents to end their homophobia. On the level of their understanding. And I think that part of the tragedy of a lot of radical progressive movement is we have felt like we want to impose these beliefs. We want to push this on you. We want to tell you what's the right way to think. And not that I want to come to you in the place where you reside and be able to be with you there. That I want to be in the space of prayer with those who pray and share the things that I pray about. The things that are on my heart, not to make light of people who pray, not to put people who pray down, because it just doesn't work that we get anything across. And those are the hard lessons of learning how to organize, and how to do activism, and how to share knowledge. Just as Pima Children said, start where you are. You know, begin where you are. Begin with people where they are. I had to hear a lot of quotes from Turkle's book, Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. And he gave all these things like 53% of non-blacks believe black folks are less intelligent than whites, 51% that we are less patriotic, 56% that we are more violence prone. In a nation where at that time President Clinton had asked Congress to increase military spending more than $110 billion over the next 6 years, the largest increase in military spending since Reagan's first term, that has spent $5.5 trillion on nuclear weapon development since 1940, and 62% believe that black people are more violent, that we are more likely to prefer to live off welfare, and less likely to prefer to be self-supporting. Most white Americans still do not live in neighborhoods with black folks, work with any large number of us, attend predominantly black churches, schools, fellowship with us outside work. Real estate continues to do a business so informed by the politics of white supremacy as to ensure the continuation of an ipso facto racial apartheid. To this day, our legal system makes it so difficult to prove that racial discrimination in housing takes place that hardly anyone bothers to contest the many cases where it occurs. Not to mention that part of why this contestation does not occur is that black folks have deep fear of white racial terrorism and violence. After all, we know no incident where black people have bombed buildings to murder innocent white children or anybody else. But we certainly know that white people in this country sanctioned by the state. I mean, remember the bombing of those people in Philadelphia, the people who had dreadlocks, and all we were ever told is that they didn't smell right when they did homeschooling. So that throughout this particular paper, I'm talking about that resurgence of white supremacy. Because on one hand, we're hearing all this stuff. Notice that Bush didn't really have anything to say yesterday about race and racism. And we're just always hearing about the demographics. Today I said, well, how many Chicanas and Chicanos are here at Lewis and Clark? Because all we're hearing is about the demographics and how there's going to be this whole world of Spanish-speaking or Spanish origin students waiting to be educated. What are we doing to get ready for them? Or do people really believe that they're just going to be a larger servant class to serve the needs of white supremacy? And one of the issues that we're struggling with everywhere in this nation, every predominantly white liberal arts college is struggling with the fact of dwindling resources, dwindling positions for faculty. How then can we talk about diversity? How then can we talk about having an inclusive environment? when there are so few jobs? You know, we argue all the time in our schools, how is it that people of color come but they're never good enough?
Then I talked today about what I said, unlike white people worshiping at the throne of black mediocrity. That is how, like, the white people don't choose the excellent qualified candidate, but they choose the person, oh, they haven't finished their degree. You know, and you stand there as a black person and say, you know, I think it's better if we don't hire people who haven't finished their degrees, because studies show that it's actually much harder for people of color to finish their dissertations, you know, when they're expected to sit on every committee, I mean, chair programs and departments when they don't have tenure, et cetera, et cetera. And yet we just see the repetition of so many patterns that haven't worked. Well, okay, Lewis and Clark, the reality is, if we want to have an anti-racist, non-white supremacist learning environment, which students deserve, we have to be willing to think outside the box. We have to be willing to do something daring. Like, for example, Miss Bell Hooks decides she's tired of life in New York City. She needs to get out of the city and go to a smaller environment. She calls up the Women's Studies Director at Berea College and says, you know, I think Berea College would be a good place for me. And she says, oh, no way, there's no money, there's no, you know, there's just not enough money. And I said, well, money isn't an issue. You know, I don't require a lot of money. And it's just very interesting, because you think about how often you hear, like, we can't get a black person, but they're not qualified. So there I'm offering myself. This is my students, I want you to know the power of students. Because all I had to do was go there and give a talk and say that I wanted to come and work there. The students begin to galvanize their energy in league with a wonderful white female feminist colleagues. I don't know how many of you know about Berea, but like so many colleges, our faculty believe that everything has to be democratic, you know? You can't get a quarter if I'm gonna die. You know, everybody has to get that same dime. So I want you to know that black and white, many people of color and white people opposed my appointment initially because I wanted to be a distinguished professor in residence. I wanted to teach along a model that I've been developing where I don't give grades, I teach faculty, staff, and students. And I do specialized course. And I want to say that this started at Southwestern University in Texas, again with white feminist lesbian allies, that I wanted to try an experimental teaching about community. Because we say, let's have diversity, but how can we have diversity when faculty and staff have unlimited racism? How can we have any kind of Southwestern, people kept saying, we're so white. The campus is so white. And all around us are all the Hispanic people and the black people who make that college run. So I said, no, the campus is not white. Our community is not white. The fact is, we don't value the people of color because they're not professors. You know, so they allowed me to teach the same kind of model that I've used at Berea. For I teach a course where faculty, staff, and students can come. And believe it or not, you would think there'd be a lot of people, but I teach it early in the morning. So it's not jam-packed with people, but people also from the community can come. Because my intentionality is, what does it mean to think of learning? What for learning's sake? Of learning about hard issues together. You know, it's like, sort of like in our first class when the faculty talked about what a liberal open community we had, and the staff was saying, liberal and open. You should hear how these professors talk to us when no one else is around. So that we really dealt with the question of building community. And how do we do that? And it was a challenge to me. The president with these people who are going to make life-changing decisions about someone's job. How do you create genuine openness in that space? You know, our president wasn't happy to hear me say, I think we have a white supremacist school. You know, despite our commitment to impartial love and racial justice. And how do we begin to change that? What do we do? And we do fun things like people interview people. We try to talk about who belongs. Who belongs at Lewis and Clark? You know, who does this institution belong to? Does it belong to the native people? You know, who have the husbandry of this land, all the beautiful, enormous nature that is preserved for our pleasure today? You know, who have the husbandry of that land? You know, who kept it so that it is even here for us in eternity to have and to think about and to explore? It's so deep to try to think about community in terms of a holistic environmentalism so that we can look at the role of nature and of people in nature as part of it. Think about all you white people here who enjoy the nature that is here in Portland, Oregon. At my wonderful place, I'm staying at this funky little place, the Lakeshore Inn, and I'm loving every minute of it. And I see the ducks outside my window. I'm telling you, I said, I'm moving to Portland, and I was ready to buy my little place on the lake. And so until Lisa said to me, I said, well, what will a studio cost me? She was like, I think they're going starting at like $600,000. I was like, oh, well, no place on the lake for me. For whom this land is home, for whom this land once provided a culture of belonging. I won't be later, but I'll go back in and finish my talk so we can talk together. Faced with living in a crisis culture of meta-crisis, we are besieged by war, disease, economic depression, global hunger, unprecedented natural disasters, flooding, hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, as well as the loss of credibility in people leadership, in the ethics of our government, intellectuals, critics, critical thinkers everywhere. Everywhere I go, everyday working people and the rest of us are all pondering in different ways and on different levels what we must do to survive, to thrive, to be safe, to live well, to know what our values are and how to actualize them. Where is the place of struggle in our lives? Where to begin, what to do, how to find enough time? We're all seeking. This is what I believe we share, all people everywhere, the search for well-being. Single, living alone, I feel more fear in my daily life than ever before. The world around me feels more threatening. I worry that my life has been invaded, that the fascist surveillance that has become so commonplace, so commonly accepted as normal in our culture, means that there's someone listening to everything I say in the privacy of my home, listening to the erratic breathing that characterizes my menopausal scene, listening to me cry out from yet another nightmarish dream in which I'm violently attacked, startles me, and I wake up screaming, making blood-curdling cries I can't even mimic in broad daylight. I don't think there's anyone in our nation who loves justice and cherishes freedom, who's not at times panicked, overcome with worry about the fate of democracy. As individuals on the left who are dissident, who are critical of our national politics and policies, are particularly vulnerable. Many of us found ourselves assailed by attackers and critics in the wake of 9/11 and the call for a constant war against terrorism. Publicly, the voices of individual women opposing war, opposing the heteropatriarchal politics, underlying the demand for more and more debt in the interests of imperialist white supremacists, capitalist patriarchy were rarely heard.
When writer Susan Sontag, who now we know has passed, dared to raise her voice in protest, she was violently critiqued. I think these are times in which it is very hard to have a radical voice. So my challenge to you here at Lewis and Clark is to do the work of creating that space of radical openness that can allow for dissent. It's very painful today to hear students say, you know, you can go along and if the issue of race comes up, you can have your buddies, you can talk about everything, but if race and racism comes up, there's this wall that happens between students. And I thought that was like so sad, because to me, the whole wonderfulness of a true liberal arts education is that it teaches us to cherish openness, to cherish hearing an opinion differently from the one we may hold. As I always tell my students, I don't want you to leave my class being little bell hooks. I want you to leave knowing how to be a critical speaker, knowing how to ask the who, what, when, where, why, and how questions for yourself and for the decisions that you will make in your life and in the lives of others that you may end up ruling over. So that's my challenge to all of you here, both those of you who are students and teachers and those of you who come from a larger community, to think about what are the conditions necessary for radical openness, for democracy. And I was thinking, okay, on a certain kind of cool level, I was thinking, it's so good to push gay to save the union, because I'm well going to get the state of the subcultural union. Very concerned about censorship and our right to free speech and our right to speak openly about race, homophobia, sexism. You know, I was really struck. Did you pay attention to the woman who was arrested because she came in, she had her ticket to the address, but she had on an anti-war t-shirt? And no one said in anything I've read where the rules are, but evidently you're not supposed to wear an anti-war t-shirt. And I was thinking about what a small thing that is. And yet I thought about, what about democracy? You know, I was listening to Bob Dylan. I one of those people that still has tapes. In our daily lives. And thinking about the world that my students and many of you live within, well, what are you doing for justice and peace? Where is your activism? What are you doing for radical openness? You know, I even move when I tell people that I have hope for George Bush. I can't give up my hope that George Bush could have some radical transformation. And then he began to rethink certain things he believed all his life. I think it's enormously crucial to have hope in people's capacity to have awareness and to change. You know, I think that one day Colin Powell will speak truthfully and honestly, and we will know how much he learned from being the first black man in this nation to really sit at the top seats of power in this country, and to hear what the imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchal people said. You know, I tell people all the time, I have tremendous admiration for Colin Powell, fascist, imperialist, militarist that he is. Because I believe that he had tremendous and had integrity of spirit. When the Bush administration wanted him to denounce affirmative action, he never did. He consistently said, if it were not for affirmative action, I would not be where I am. He has a level of integrity that I can respect, even as I can disagree with his profound imperialism, militarism, and white supremacy. Because if we go back in his career and look at what he said about the people of Iraq, and Iran. I mean, it's all there, the fascism, the hatred, but I think he's made tremendous changes that he cannot yet speak to us about, and may not be able to speak to us about in his lifetime. You know, and I think that isn't it fascinating, and I'll begin to close, that both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X made tremendous changes right before they were assassinated, that they had both begun to deconstruct their notions of black power. They had begun to think globally. Martin Luther King had begun to write about new technologies, you know, militarism, imperialism, all of those things. And, you know, do you remember when you think of these two men? They were very young. They were in their early 30s. It awes me now to think about the fact that they were so young. As I look at the development of my own critical thought, as I see myself changing and growing and expanding, I think, who would they have become? Both of them had begun to rethink questions of gender. What might they have been to us? Had they been able to take on a feminist politics and a feminist perspective and share that with the rest of the world? We have seen again and again that black men and women, white men and women, people of color who oppose racism, often support sexism and class exploitation. That white women who are outraged by sexism help perpetuate and maintain structures of racism and white supremacy. That progressive white men who critique capitalism do not challenge sexist and racist thinking and behavior. As long as any of us support domination in any form, we keep in place the structures which uphold imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist, patriarchy. Those systems of domination cannot be effectively challenged and changed until we are willing to resist domination in all its forms. Loving justice means that we are willing to see the ways the interconnectedness of race, sex, class, sexual practice and preference work together. It would serve us well to heed the warning posed by Dr. King when he professionally declared that we needed a revolution of values in this society, emphasizing when machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism, and here I would add sexism, are incapable of being conquered. Our hope lies in facing these truths and rededicating ourselves to a vision of life where freedom and justice for all is no longer a dream, but the reality to be embraced if we are to survive, if the planet is to survive. It is only as we work for change that we can see clearly that change can happen, that our lives can be transformed, that we can renew our spirits and rekindle our hope. Thank you. Teacher in Flint, Michigan, and she made me
get out and do my bit in the public school, you know, I was there with my little happy to be nanny motion. She wants me to touch it, and the teachers are saying, no! What did they say? Then they came up later and said, you know, she has lice. Wash your hands. I don't know, it's such a powerful moment that no matter what was happening to her head, this little girl was proud of her head. I think that whenever we talk to groups of people, like, I go to Flint, Michigan, and these kids, they want to know what I'm doing. They come off the bell, and so they say to me, what kind of car do you drive? And I know it's because their parents have said to them, you can make more working in the plant than you will ever make as a professor. You know? And so I just go there and ask them, oh, well, that's a silly question. What kind of car do I drive? I want to talk to them about what kind of car I drive. Of course, I happen to drive those cute, you know, wonderful luxury cars. But what I love about it is that it challenges their notion of what a feminist is, of what a professor it is, of what is possible. And we can begin from there. So if you're going to New Orleans and talk to any group of people, I think we have to talk to people where they are. And how we know where people are, we have to ask them the question. And we have to be willing to listen. And I mean, earlier today, I think it was Mama Jo who was talking about the capacity to listen as part of an intervention, especially when we deal with difference, when we deal across the lines of the class lines. I mean, there's nothing that's made a greater difference in my life than having so much more money than my siblings. And the kind of conflict that arise in communication. You know, my brother was asking me for some advice about his life, and he has a job he hates, and I was telling him, you know, that he should leave this job. And he was like, well, that's easy for you to say. And I was like, I left jobs back when I wasn't Bell Hooks, who had fame and a certain amount of money, because of my Buddhist belief in my livelihood. But he wasn't asking me to think I was worthy enough. I was just a like dirty old hippie girl. He would not have asked me for advice about his life then. But now I'm worthy. But then he doesn't want to hear what I have to say because he doesn't believe that he can trust the voice out of which I speak, which he sees as the voice of class privilege. So, you say, come on up to this mic. Oh, wait. You might have to cut me off. Okay, your name?
My name is Megan Wilson. I'm a public school teacher without a job in social studies, but that's okay. I am asking about sort of this, the anti-intellectualism that exists in the United States and how we've created this sort of educated versus uneducated and how we take away intellectual, like how we just get rid of the class in that. Do you know what I mean? Like classism and the anti-intellectualism.
I don't think we can do any of that without literacy. And that's why, like, I think that I tell my students all the time that you don't have to go to Belize, you don't have to go to many places in the world for work with reading and writing. I mean, how many of you donate a book to your local library in an impoverished neighborhood? I mean, there's so much intervention of school libraries, you know, in underfunded locations. I mean, there's so much intervention to be done around reading. I mean, I don't think we can hope to deal with intellectualism if we can't even live in a world where we can restore to children a sense of reading and writing matters. You know, and that's why, so I do a lot of work in the public school system. I do a lot of work with public libraries. Because I believe that if children are not able to experience the magic of a book as that thing which can change their way of looking at the world, then they won't really be able, I mean, and we're talking today about media. I don't know, did any of you see seeing my little book happen to be brought to the screen, and they read the book, Mary J. Blige, she's very bad reading the book. I said, I don't think Mary has ever read to a child before in her life. But they interview little black girls in the video as they are reading the Happy to Be Nappy book, and the girls, little girls, are talking, you know, saying how I'm saying their hair is like flower petals, soft like flower petals, and how much this means to them. And I think all the time about how much a book can change one's life, one's ways of thinking. So I feel like if we want to deal with anti-intellectualism, we have to restore, books are different from computers, texts, because books allow you that space where you can pause, think, go back, without a lot of effort, with no electricity bill, you know, no need for a lot of light. You know, all the things, because I think we don't take seriously the amount of electricity that consumes. I'm really obsessed with the environment and how much electricity we waste. I mean, did you kind of find it amusing when Bush was talking about our addiction to oil? I was like, let's change that to our addiction to excess, which oil is just one thing. You know, I mean, it's amazing when you think about it. We can have a crisis in gas, and people can go out and buy the biggest SUVs the next day, as if there's never been any discussion about dwindling resources. You know, that we can talk about electrical blackouts, and people can keep lights going. People get upset with me that I don't keep lights going in my house when I'm not there. Because, of course, the culture of fear tells us lights will really save you. Keep those lights going for the 2 months you're not home, though. So no one will break into your house. Come on up to this mic. See, can you get tired and start getting off with it? I have to tell myself to be quiet. Your name?
I'm Carla Sonia Tejas, and I'm a public school principal at middle school.
Cool.
Inner city middle school. I think it's the outer city, but we forgot that the inner city moved to the outer city because no one can afford the inner city. But anyway, that's it. I interrupted seven boys in my school who were comparing their color. They had replicated white supremacy and sexism and homophobia. And they had totally, one little boy was almost in tears. He's the blackest, he's the baddest, he's ugly.
That uses the image I feel we have to do is create a more loving image of Black boys in this nation. You know?
Therapist intern finishing up my program here, and I have to work with teen parents, and the book I make gave this to a client who hasn't finished her GED yet, and she got herself a dictionary, and she's going through this book, and she's an African American herself, and she has a biracial child, and then her teen best friend, who is in a relationship with an African American male, and he has a biracial child, they started a little reading group, and it's really shifted their perception.
Times when I might use that word in relationship to her, but she's being
As long as certain forms of domination exist in the dailiness of our lives, we are not liberating anything. You know, I lived next door to these young black men for a while, and I was so surprised at the language they used to talk to each other every day, and it broke my heart. But it's the language of popular, crass, vulgar vernacular. And I must tell you, I love vulgar vernacular. And I have been working in my spiritual practice not to curse as much as I do. Because I do think that there's a violence to that vernacular language, as much as I might enjoy it, you know? And so I think that that, again, is about what is the context and what kind of things that, though they may be hilariously funny, do we want to give up because they're no longer healthy for us? I mean, black people, I think, are probably stand alone as the ethnic group that has the most tried to turn degrading things into ways that we laugh at ourselves. And I feel like there are a lot of things we just need to let go. You know, because it's not furthering our development. Your name?
My name's Kelly, and first, if you're worse than that, I want to let you know that I profound amount of respect for you as an educator, all the other educators in your I want to be a teacher.
Okay.
And it's looking tough. I see my mom burn out through schools, and had a teacher at this school tell me that it's not the right way to go. It moves too slow. It's too conventional. I just want to ask you personally how you do it, how you can continue to struggle and swim upstream.
I think that it's no accident that I've been writing in my last. A lot of the work I'm doing right now is on spirituality, because I don't know if you guys would just like go home and read everything Bellis has ever written. You'll find that I say very little about spirituality in my early books. But as some of you who like any sort of follow me know, as many of my students begin to commit suicide, attempt to commit suicide, and commit suicide, students would come to my office and ask me, you know, what keeps you going? I felt the need to bring out of the closet my spiritual life and my life in prayer, which is important to me as something that keeps me going. So that I think that, because, you know, having a meditative life, whether it's in conventional prayer or however you do it, a lot of times I think we burn out as people who serve justice because we don't know when to stop. We don't know when to quit. I had to go to the doctor to ask the doctor, could I really come to Portland? Because there's sometimes when I'm so, you know, convinced that I have to do it, that I can't see that my body may not be capable of doing it. And I am particularly a lover of that scripture that says, be still and know that I'm God, because sometimes it's in the stillness of my prayer and meditative practice that I learn what I need to do to renew my spirit. And so that I think that what I tell people, what I told women of color students today in talking with them, is that I think it's very important for us to know who we are and to know how much we can bear and how much we can do. As I look back on my life and the lives of so many black women writers who have died young and who have suffered tremendous disease, I think that we haven't taken enough time for our spiritual and emotional renewal and our health. And we talked today, I thought, with students somewhat marvelously about how living in a culture of domination is so obsessed with efficiency. It's often very hard to do what you need to be well, especially for women and women of color, because everything might won't run as smoothly. I mean, just even saying, you know, like me coming here, and as some of you know, I'll be at Reed tomorrow night, and then I'll be in Eugene, and deciding that it might be helpful to me to sleep in the same bed. That requires people making lots of changes. And I think that the efficiency culture doesn't affirm optimal well-being. So that I feel like for any student of mine that wants to be a teacher, wouldn't some of us old people in this room have been a lot happier if we'd been told, you know, you're not probably going to want to do the same job for 30 or 40 years. You know, that I think I try to encourage my students to think about both ands, to think about
about multiple things that they have passion about. Because what I now know is most of us won't want to do something. I'm a great teacher, can't you tell? I'm a fantastic teacher. But I reached a point a few years ago where I didn't want to teach full-time anymore. Where I felt that the level of exhaustion and everything, but, you know, and trying to get people to see that. They were like, but you do this. You're so glad. I kept saying, but it's no longer something that serves me in my holistic self. And so I would say that to you, that if you have a vision of being a teacher and you're wise enough to know the strain, then you have to plan for that strain. Maybe I'll be a teacher for 4 years, you know, and then I'll think about some other way that I can contribute. Next question. Your name?
My name is Kurt Kester. I have the privilege of working for this wonderful student body as one of their groundskeepers.
Wonderful. Thank you for being here.
And thank you to the students for using the proper waste receptacle. As a gay person who has experienced homophobia and a gay person whose previous boyfriend is African American, and I have seen and heard the racism against him, and a person who has experienced sexism towards female friends, how do we take it from this level of a safe environment in forums and classrooms where we think about it and put the spark of courage in all of these wonderful human beings' hearts to take that very uncomfortable, very unsafe step to speak out, to act out, just to act on their conventions, because it's a very, it's not a friendly place to be, but it's a necessary place to be.
Well, I think that you said it yourself, I mean, that it takes that courage of, and wanting to be public as somebody who loves justice. You know, I ask my students, what are you doing for justice? When you wake up in the morning, do you ask yourself, what am I gonna do for peace today? Right where you are, not what you're gonna join, not what, you know, glory in your activism you're gonna get by meeting, you know, the struggle, but just for today, what are you gonna do in the space that you live to end domination? And sometimes I do that as a spiritual practice in my week life, my daily life, to say, Bells, what are you gonna do? Not what book you're gonna write, not what lecture you're gonna give, but what are you gonna do today in the dailiness of where you live to end domination? And Lisa could tell you, I've been sharing with her my whole Martin Luther King moment thing where I try to, you know, I've been very important. I've been talking to a lot of my people today, just in everyday life today, you know, saying pleasant things, speaking, but look at me with utter shock, like a black person is talking to me and I don't know her. And I told Lisa, well, you see, this is a Martin Luther King moment because I'm doing the work of civil rights, of humanizing, of not allowing someone else to make me invisible. I'll be like, I didn't see you, your girl. How are you doing? I think of the work that Adrienne Piper has done, a black woman who looks white, and who all her life has had white people say racist things, and the kind of interventions she's tried to do with her art projects with the note cards. You know, like she could pass out a card saying, I know you made that racist statement because you think I'm white, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, just that there are interventions we can do with the dailiness of our lives. Your name?
I'm Kate. And I'm just wondering, affirmative action has kind of become a sexy topic recently. And
where?
On this campus, at least. And it's kind of hard to know where the information about it is coming from. And I find myself having a hard time knowing who to trust, and I'm hearing a lot of anti-affirmative action sentiments, as well as pro-affirmative action sentiments, which I've heard most of my life, I think. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. And
well, see, I think that it's so much more important to talk about ending domination and ending white supremacy, because the moment we use the language like affirmative action, it allows people to fall back these defensive positions or closed positionalities, but if we talk about, like if we just were posing the question to everyone here at the listening block, what are we doing to end white supremacy on this campus? What are we doing to make this campus a place where people of color might want to come to hear a lecture, to school, to teach, to work? I think those are the kind of questions that steer us away from simplistic arguments about affirmative action. And I think that one of the most meaningful things I said here tonight, if you want to end racism and white supremacy and other forms of domination, you have to be willing to think outside the box. And I didn't finish that I feel that Berea College, against the will of many of my colleagues, was willing to think about outside the box and say, let's have a bell hooks come here, even though, you know, she may be getting a quarter, and we're all used to getting dimes, and we don't feel she should be getting a dime. You know, that people can think more substantively about what does a bell hooks bring. Because you see, I came out of that environment that the vast majority of our students are coming out of. So I mean something very different to them than other professors who come from New York or who come, you know, I represent them, to them what's possible if you come from the Kentucky backwoods. You know, you don't know what fork to use. If you've never seen, been on an airplane or a city bus or know what an escalator is, that was me when I went to Stanford. You know, next question, if I'm gonna move along here, I'm really getting tired. Your name?
My name's Marcus. And I'm wondering, I really appreciate what you said about meeting people where they are and communicating with people where they're at. And I'm wondering how you deal with it when you try to get and to encounter people who aren't really trying to communicate with you or don't want to meet people where they're at, don't even want to have that dialogue in the first place.
Well, see, I think that we have a lot of glorious lessons to learn from the recovery movement. And those of you who are in AA or NA, don't you love when NA teaches you are, I mean, AA, don't try to have a conversation with them wrong, okay? Don't try to have a deep and profound how it will change your life for somebody who's using whatever their mission is. And so if I'm around people that clearly have no interest in what I have to say and aren't open to change, why am I going to waste my time trying to talk to them? You know, why can't I be respectful towards them and say, you clearly aren't interested at this moment in here what I have to say, and if there ever is a moment, you know, look me up. You know, but because I think that this is another thing that students at liberal arts colleges often do is spend a lot of time knocking on the doors that are never going to open and then hating the place that you are because those doors don't open. Forget about those doors. You know, buy a kid a book. I mean, there are all kinds of, you know, activism that you can do that will soothe your soul. Let me just tell you, like, I've had a lot of traumatic abuse around holiday times. And this time at Christmas time, I decided that I was meditating on the scripture, God was a cheerful giver. And I decided that every day of my life, I would give indiscriminately. I would just look upon the situation. You know, everybody here that came earlier knows that I shop at Goodwill. And so I'm shopping at the Goodwill, for example, and I hear this white woman, Appalachian white woman, saying, this is the worst Christmas of my life. We don't have any money, blah, 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 blah. That's a situation in which one can have a moment of giving and activism. It's not about, like, display of what have you. And I apologize because I think it's immodest to talk about situations of giving, but it's a good example of how, if we don't waste our energy knocking on those doors that are never going to open, we can think about other doors and other connections and other ways of building solidarity. Next question.
Greetings. My name is Bruce. I'm a Buddhist and I'm a peaceful and compassionate person, but I get mad. I get mad when I see what are otherwise very thoughtful administrators, you know, cutting the budget of janitorial staff to the extent that it's beyond what our communities really accept. And so you politely inform people, well, you've gone too far, months and months and months goes by, and then you get a little more fierce and they say, well, tone down the rhetoric, and I say, well, tone up the action. So I'm wondering, like, how do you deal with anger, and how do you get yourself into a space where you can draw those administrators, those thoughtful, kind-hearted people, back into a really healthy discussion about how to make this socially just place where janitors and all workers are embraced?
I think that that's very difficult.
like, oh my gosh, I'm meeting the teacher and I failed. And that was a moment in life when he told me, hold on to your anger. And he said, and use it as compost for your garden. And so I think that to think of ways that we can use our anger for awareness, for insight, to think about how can we present things to people in ways that may make them think again. You know, wouldn't it be great if a lot of the people who made decisions about the janitors could be janitors for a week, could live within that energy and that space. Thank you so much.